shore, stranded by the tide, their iridescent, bladder-like forms sometimes alone on the wet sand, sometimes entangled in seaweed. These lilac-tinted bubbles could deliver a lash-like sting, as Kali knew from painful experience. He had once tried to pick one up, and ever since had harboured vindictive feelings towards them. Whenever he came to one now, he stopped and pricked it with the point of his knife. As the gas was released, the puffed-out sack collapsed with a comical squeak like a fart of farewell. Each time it happened, Kali chuckled to himself and mocked the deflated jellyfish with squeaking sounds of his own. He looked up gleefully from this sport to see a fretting and worrying of waves around a dark shape at the waterline some distance ahead of him. He thought at first it might be a section of the trimmed hardwood timber sometimes washed up from cargo ships, but it was too short for that and too light. The water was lifting and moving it this way and that. Then he saw that it was the body of a Negro, not fully grown. The sex he could not determine yet. As he drew nearer, the movements of the body seemed like a sort of languid play. He saw now that it was a boy. Kali stopped and stood looking. It came to his mind that the sea was bringing this body to life. Kali knew there were spirits. He saw and heard them everywhere about him. They informed his dreams. In a shaft of awe, below any power of words, it seemed to him that this Negro boy would presently crawl up out of the sea. Then he saw the staring eyes and the slight, helpless gestures of the hands, and he knew the boy was dead. He went forward and drew the body out of the water and laid it higher up on the beach. The boy was perhaps 10 or 11 years old, and his body was whole. He had escaped sharks in the deep water, and crabs in the shallows, and the vultures that would have found him soon. He was emaciated. His cage of ribs was clearly visible beneath the skin, the collarbone like a halter on him. There was a brand mark on his chest, on the right side, above the nipple. The scar was red, still new. Kali fell now into a painful state of anxiety and indecision. He stood looking from the dead boy to the empty shore and sea and sky. He was absolutely alone, with the responsibility of this discovery, nothing to guide or help him. He could leave the body where it was and walk on as if nothing had happened. He would never speak about it. No one would know. Would Deacon have done that? Deacon would not just walk away from the dead child. Deacon would take the body and show people. He stopped and picked up the boy in his arms. The body was ice-cold, and Kali shivered slightly at the contact of this cold flesh against his own. He hoisted the slight form across his shoulders and resumed his way. Soon he became accustomed to his burden. He walked on steadily, his mind vacant, aware only of the washing sound of the waves, the growing warmth of the sun. Also abroad early was a young man called Sifadu, whom love had made restless. He had risen with the first light and paddled for 2 hours through the channels on the edge of the flooded sawgrass plain towards the dark line of a jungle island on the horizon. The water levels had begun to sink, but he often hunted here for duck and quail, and he knew the floodlands well. He had been born in the Bolilands of Sierra Leone, a region not much different, flooded in the rainy season and dry in winter. In the narrow, flat-bottomed canoe, which he had hollowed out himself from a single trunk, he could pass at a level of a few inches. The tall grass grew close, and the minute teeth on the blades cut his arms and shoulders sometimes, but his purpose was fixed, and the fire in his mind steady, so that he hardly noticed these wounds, or the indignant herons and spoonbill birds that flapped up with heavy wing beats at his approach. He tied up the canoe at the edge of the hummock, among pads of water-shield plants, still cupping their catch of dew, and stepped into the green twilight of the trees. He had been here before, and knew there was a wide sinkhole on this side, not far into the trees, a deep hollow in the rock bed, which was the hummock's foundation. Thrusting through the close-growing vegetation, beating before him with a stick to warn snakes, he came upon it. It was deep still, brimming with clear, dark water. A lacework of duckweed floated at the edges, but the centre held nothing save the glinting reflections of the foliage above it. Here, among the trees, there was no sound. Sepharduus stood at the edge of the pool, looking across to the sharp outcrop that thrust like wrinkled knuckles through the peat mould on the other side. These creases of rock were what had brought him. He had remembered the dark interior of this hummock, the cracked limestone, and the complicated roots of the trees edging the pool. It was a perfect place for ground pearls, the most coveted of all ornaments among the women. He wanted to make a necklace for Dinka, so she would know his love. He was 3 years younger than she, the youngest adult of the settlement, having been not yet 10 years old when brought here. He had been a well-grown child, and Thurso had thought him older. He was Temni speaking, like Tongman, but that was all they had in common, since Sepharduus was not interested in dealing, but in making things, and especially decorative things, though he made cutting tools and arrowheads also. He was tall and long-legged, rather narrow in build, with heavy-lidded eyes that gave his face a totally misleading expression of indolence. The pause had been for something in the nature of a strong wish addressed to the spirit of his maternal grandmother, who had been a great gleaner and finder. Now he moved carefully round to the far side of the pool and began his search. After he'd been there some time, a brief but heavy shower descended. He stood patiently where he was, waiting to resume, watching the bark of the trees darken with wet. The rain stopped abruptly, and he immediately began searching again, with the drenched leaves dripping down on him and the slow ack-ack of the grateful tree-frogs resounding through the hummock. It was an hour or so before he found the first pearls, caught among the exposed roots of a pond-apple, four small opaque lumps, roseate and waxy, glistening softly among the dark root-hairs. There were two more in the soil below. He put them in the skin bag he wore round his neck and searched on without pausing. He felt neither hunger nor fatigue. By mid-afternoon his bag contained 38 pearls, all roughly the same size, enough to make a necklace. He set off back immediately, wanting to make the most of the light. Once again in the compound, he started work without pausing to eat or rest. His hut was also his workshop, and he had everything here that he needed. Sailmaker's needles, steel pins, chisels, all begged at various times from the people of the crew. Some, when he was still a child, he had always been clever at making things. Now he worked with application to pierce the pearls, the movements of his hands assured and delicate, his face set in a slight frown of concentration, joy and anxiety contending within him. Somewhere not far away he could hear the voices of children. They were acting out the story of Wilson. He recognised the dialogue of the quarrel. Sepharduus knew this story well. He had witnessed the execution of Wilson as a child, and he had never forgotten it. The big man and his white, unbelieving face, the ragged volley of the muskets fired by black men and white men together, all the men of the settlement. The voices of the unseen children carried to him, rapid, high-pitched, the actors scarcely distinguishable one from another, using words they knew by heart.
"We here is two man, one woman. You can do matematic, yes or no? We got to share this woman." "I no share with you. I want fuck this woman for wife." "We go ask woman then. Woman, you take us share two husband?" "Yes, certain. I take you."
No excuse had been found for Wilson's crime. He had waited in hiding and stabbed a man to death, a negro, over a quarrel about sharing a woman. Sepharduus had not understood matters fully at the time. Those early days were clouded and confused with the terrors of the voyage and the hardships they had suffered on first landing. As a child aboard the slave ship, he had seen death come in fearsome ways. He had heard people shrieking around him in the stinking darkness, and he had joined in, screaming, not knowing whether it was fear of death or desire for release. But this public death that Wilson had suffered was not like any other he had seen. The white man had been brought out and tied up and slaughtered like an animal. He had not struggled, he had not believed it. He had walked among the people as if in a dream. Wilson had been killed by everybody. It was this that made his death special, the children had been told. It was justice, It was all the people showing how much they hated this crime. Killing was justice when everybody joined in. At 10, Sefadu had not been able to understand this, because his idea of justice was more personal. It puzzled him still, 12 years later. Killing Wilson had been good for the settlement. It had shown the black people that their lives were valuable to the white people, but he could not see how that could be called justice. Del Blanc, dead now himself, had been the great talker for Wilson's death, just as he was talking for it again, now, in piping tones, outside the hut.
"Turn you ass about. I talking to you. What you name?"
"My name Wilson."
"Wilson, you kill one man. How can people live together if they do that? How can they learn share woman if they do that? The world fall in pieces if they do that. So now we all go kill you, Wilson."
They had tied Wilson to a tree and discharged their muskets at close range into his body. Sefadu remembered how, at that sudden explosion of sound, great flocks of birds had risen from the marshes. For some moments their wings had filled the sky. Wilson had hung in his ropes all that day and the next, for everyone to see. Sefadu paused to blow dust from the mouth of the tiny hole he was making. The little line of pearls on his low bench was diminishing slowly. He sat cross-legged on the floor to work, in the light of the entrance. The image of Dinka came into his mind as he had seen her last. The shapely arms, the proud carriage of the head, the long, narrow eyes, both languorous and mocking. On her lower lip, close to the join, there was a tender flush of blood, dark pink, as if at some previous time this lip had been turned a little more inward into the protective softness of the mouth. Sullivan, too, was busy that afternoon. He was replacing a broken string in his fiddle. He would win Dinka by the power of music, and he desired the instrument of persuasion to be in best possible condition. Sullivan's life from earliest childhood had been too hard for him to maintain much consistency of principle or opinion, that is for more sheltered folk, but he had retained a belief in music as an aid to love. He had been alerted to the need for swift action by his talk with Billy and Nchebi, and his realization that both of them had a fancy for Dinka, in spite of being settled men with a good wife. He was by no means convinced that his praise for Salian had done much to make them see the error of their ways. Indeed, he was rather afraid that his words had misfired and roused their suspicions, Nchebi's particularly. Nchebi was a subtle and guileful fellow. There was a good deal to fear from this quarter, Sullivan felt. Fortune had favoured him in the shape of a fresh-killed deer brought in by Hughes the day before. He had selected a length of gut from the carcass, and had squeezed and nipped the blood and excrement out of it with utmost care, pulling it repeatedly between finger and thumb until it was clean and sweet as he could make it. All night it had been soaking in a strong lye of wood ash. Now he had begun to peel away the softened film of skin lining the outside, a task requiring patience and devotion and lightness of touch, all of which qualities Sullivan brought to it and desired also to bring to Dinka. Meanwhile, as he worked, his hopes rose. He whistled between his teeth a tune of his boyhood, Katie Brannigan. His plan was formed, and he felt that it was a good one. He would tune his fiddle to the maximum tenderness it was capable of. He would wait for nightfall. After the evening meal, when things had settled down, he would make his way to Dinka's hut, which fortunately was one of those on the edge of the settlement. Once there, he would sit outside her door and give her a tune or two. He would serenade her. He had chosen the tunes already, "Oh, Hear Me" and "Rose of Ireland." She would be moved by the beauty of it. She would take him in, he would be home and dry. Perhaps she would offer him, in the way of preliminary courtesy, a drop of grain beer. Dinka made an excellent grain beer. Of course, there would be something public in it. People round would be certain to hear him. They would come crowding out to see this prodigy of song, but Sullivan had never been averse to an audience. And Dinka would not mind her neighbours knowing she was desired by one of the main music-makers of the place. She would be pleased. It was... He sought for the word in his mind, homage. Sullivan knew women. Women liked homage, the world over. He made a narrow loop at one end of the gut and passed a short toggle through it. The other end he tied to a corner post of his hut. He began to twist the gut, pausing often to run the twists higher with his fingers, increasing the tension. She was a beauty, taut and supple as any man could wish. As soon as he left the shore and began to strike inland, Kali stopped from time to time to gather pieces of pitchwood. These he laid on top of the dead child, and then roped the body and the logs together so that the sack rose high above his shoulders. He was almost doubled under this weight when he reached the first huts of the settlement. The logs were deposited for safekeeping outside Tabakali's hut. He knew she would not cheat him, and he knew she was charitable with food. On her advice, he carried the body to Paris's sick room. He was mightily relieved to be told there, by Paris himself, that he had done the right thing. The body lay there for the rest of the afternoon, under a blanket, to keep off the flies. It was quite unmarked, and Paris could discover no certain cause of death. The boy had not died by drowning. There was no water in the lungs. He had been dead when thrown over the side. It seemed likely that a flux or fever had carried him off, or the shock of captivity, Paris thought, remembering some of the deaths on board the Liverpool Merchant. Fixed melancholy, that had been Thurzo's phrase for it. But no children had died from this cause, none that he could remember, only adults. Children did not die of unhappiness. They were still too close to the dawn of life. The brand mark on the boy's chest was an S and an L, joined in the shape of a loop, with one side curving and one straight. It could be the mark of any of a thousand merchants from a dozen nations. The only one that could be definitely excluded was his uncle, K for Kemp, a long way from Liverpool to this wrecked life. There came into his mind an old adage of the Guinea traders which Barton had let fall to him once. Barton could seldom resist a quote. "Heaven is high, and Europe far away." For some time he stood there, in the long open-fronted hut where he kept his jars of herbs and his instruments and his few belongings, looking at the face of the dead boy. The faces of the dead resemble no living face, but Paris judged this boy to be about the age of his own son. Quite unexpectedly he felt the pricking of tears. Only by fortunate accident had Kenka been born to freedom and kind treatment. Several people had seen Kali with his burden, and the news of the dead boy passed around. Almost everyone in the compound or the immediate surroundings came at some time during the afternoon to see the body. They stood for a while and discussed with one another where the boy might have come from and what people he belonged to. Most saw some resemblance to their own people. Gireko's woman, Amansa, came with a funeral mat of palmetto leaf. The children stood in a ring and stared at the face whenever it was uncovered. Paris gave Kenka a task of special responsibility, much envied by the others. He was armed with a fly whisk, in the form of a stick with palm fibres fastened to it, and told to sit at the boy's head and guard his face from flies. This he did with utmost diligence and gravity, resisting all attempts of other children to relieve him. It was to remain a day of high event in Kenka's mind through all the years to come, coloured by the pride and importance of this task enjoined on him by his father. So the dead boy lay there, while his grave was being dug by Kali and Bulumiboti. Patterns of light and shade moved over him as the sun shifted lower, until finally it sank below the trees and he lay in shadow. They had decided to bury him in the common burial place, which was on a bluff at the edge of the pine ridge, overlooking a sizable creek. Here were the mounded remains of an ancient settlement of the Indians, long abandoned. The ground had been raised to a dozen feet or more by an accumulation of earth and a heavy dust of shards and shell fragments, making it possible to dig graves deep enough to cheat the animals. Customs vary, and some of the dead were elsewhere. Some lay under the huts they had lived in. Two had been exhumed and their bones placed in palm leaf baskets. But most who had died in the years of the settlement were buried here, and their graves marked by posts with an initial or abbreviated name burnt on. Stitched in their palmetto shrouds, Delblanc and Wilson had been laid to rest here, and the man Wilson had killed, and the child that Tabakali had lost. There was a post here too for Deacon. Occasionally the wandering Kali came and sat beside it, and remembered his friend. The boy was stitched into his tough shroud and slung to a pole borne by Billy Blair and Shanti Danka. On the mound of the cemetery there was some sunlight still, broken by the long, straight shadows of the grave-posts. Nadri was in the last of the sunlight as he stood beside the grave. As a man generally respected, he had been chosen to say a few words.
"Nobody sabi where this boy come from," he said. "To Vai people, he look like he come from Vai people. To Susu people, he look like he Susu, and so it go like that. Everybody say he look like de own people. This boy got no tribe cut, he got no cockskin cut. Slave mark on him. Look like done only 2-3 day. Maybe this boy nearly die already when they put burn mark, maybe not. Who put this slave mark on him? Frenchman, Englishman, Dunaman. Only thing we can say, Bokra man slaver done it. If he got no mark, tell us who he belong. We oblige say this dead pickin belong nobody. But wait 1 minute. What dat mean? My opinion dat mean he belong everybody. He belong all of us here."
Nadri's voice had deepened on this, and his listeners saw that he was moved.
"Dis pickin belong everybody," he repeated. "So we go bury this one here, 'longside us people, and we go put dat burn mark on him grave post. Dat burn mark him name."
With that, the body was lowered into the grave. Iboti, who had helped to dig the grave, stayed behind to fill it in. He was too poor a man to work for nothing, and had been promised a rabbit and a bag of chestnut meal, quite valuable this, as the nearest chestnut trees lay far to the north. This was a bad time for Iboti, perhaps the worst since the terrible days of his capture and enslavement. His woman did not want him, and treated him with scorn. He was due to be charged with witchcraft next day, and he was deeply frightened and unhappy at this. Also, he was afraid of being caught here among the dead at nightfall. For this reason he worked rapidly, protesting his innocence and uttering propitiatory phrases in a continuous mutter as he worked. He was a fearful man, and not blessed with great intelligence. Only fear of devils and hope in Tongman's advocacy kept him from running off into the night. Sullivan adhered to his plan in every detail. He ate no supper. The tension of his feelings took away appetite. There was not much to eat in any case. He had neglected to provide for himself, and he felt in no frame of mind for the communal supper at his woman's hut, along with one and quite possibly both of her other men, Libby and Zobie, and her 4 children, the latest only 1 year old. He waited in his own hut until the cooking fires were low and the mealtime gossip over. The shouts of children continued afterwards, but they too were hushed after a while. The moon was high when he emerged, and a faint light from it lay across the compound. There was a chill in the air, and a smell of wood smoke and mist. Sullivan shivered a little. He had taken pains with his appearance, tying back his long hair with a leather thong, trimming his beard, chewing mastic to clean his teeth and sweeten his breath. There were people still moving about here and there, but no one took much notice of Sullivan as he made his way to the corner of the compound where Dinka lived. No light showed from her hut, but he was not particularly surprised at this. People in the settlement generally slept early and rose with the sun. Dinka would be roused from her first sleep by his music, and what better way for a woman to wake? He chose a place some yards from the entrance and seated himself on the ground. After waiting a while to steady his breathing, he settled the fiddle to his shoulder and began to play the air of "Oh, Hear Me." He had a husky tenor voice, not very strong, but pleasing. He had used it in dusty lanes and cobbled streets of the past, in another life, singing for coppers, dragging a leg for more pathetic effect. Now he put all the feeling he knew into it. "Oh, hear me, my charmer, wouldst kill me with scorn. See the east lightens, soon cometh the dawn." He was aware of movements, voices, people stirring in the huts around, but he kept his eyes on the entrance to Dinka's. There had been no response from this quarter so far. He repeated the first two lines of the melody on his fiddle, drawing out the notes as tremulously as possible. Still no sign of anything. He began the second verse. "Hear me, oh, hear me, give ease to my pain." Abruptly he fell silent. A figure had at last appeared at the threshold, naked, but not the one hoped for, and not the right sex even, a fact grossly apparent to the staring Sullivan considerably before he knew the face for Sefadu's. The voice, when it came, was not unkind.
"She no can hear you now, fiddle man. She busy too much. Come back in de morning."
The strains of the fiddle had come to Kenka as he lay between waking and sleeping. He had heard fiddle music before and knew that it must be Sullivan. At the same time, perhaps because he was not fully awake, or because the music was distant and sad, it seemed like a voice of the night, not coming from any particular place or person. There was something magical about it, and for this reason Kenka never asked any questions concerning the music, nor indeed mentioned it to anyone until many years later, in a different place, when he was an old man and nearly blind. As he lay looking through the darkness, he heard the silence left by the ceasing of the music fill again with small accustomed sounds, faint rustles in the thatch above him, the deep regular breathing of his brother and sister lying nearby, the distant sibilance of the sea, not exactly a sound this, but a very faint escape of silence. He began to think about the night-time deer hunt which he had been promised, his first. It was due to take place very shortly now, before the full moon. Shanti Danka was back after an absence of several days. He had returned for the palaver. It was Danka who had seen the deer tracks and the cropped shoots in a hummock no more than an hour away, beyond the freshwater lagoon. Danka would be leading them. He was a notable hunter and very strong. Kenka had once measured Danka's bow against the thickness of his own wrist and found no difference. About him, as about almost all the older men of the settlement, there was a legendary glamour. Danka had been one of those who brought the ship up from the sea. Kenka had never been to the hummock where the tracks had been found, but he felt he knew it because he had questioned both Paris and Nadri at different times, and both had described it to him in detail, just as they had described the method of the hunt. There was a bay head over a narrow stream. The stream flowed out of a tunnel of moon vines, and there were small red fish in it, and it opened into a pool that was completely roofed over by the branches of trees, like a room with a floor of water. He began to rehearse the hunt in his mind, as he had done often before. Every phrase of it had taken on the colour of ritual, and everything had to be done in a precise, unvarying order. They would leave while it was still light. He would see the silver stream flowing out of the vines and the red fish flashing in the clear water. He would wade upstream with the others through the low opening in the tangle. They would wait at the edge of the clearing, making sure they were on the right side of the wind so that their scent would not be carried to the thickets where the deer came. The deer liked dark and secret places, Kenka knew. They were timid and swift to take alarm, but in spite of this, they always wanted to know the meaning of things, and it was this that was their undoing.
"Dat de thing capside them," Nadri had said. Same thing every time."
When it was growing dark, he and Tekka would be allowed to light the fires of splinterwood in the shallow pans that the men carried on their backs in a rope harness. These made a light just strong enough. Too much light would frighten the deer away.
"Deer don't stand for blazelight."
Kenka lay completely still, on his back, his hands held down by his sides. The dark shapes of the deer would approach silently through the trees, drawn by the light. They would be dazzled, but still they would come nearer, not seeing the forms of the hunters, or the tightened bows or the heavy arrows. The light of the fire would shine in their eyes would be wide open and blind. Perhaps at the last moment some fear would turn them away, but then it would be too late. There would come the twang and swish, and the deer would fall and kick for a little while, and then be still. With the death of the deer, the night would be empty. Kenka was obscurely troubled as he lay there. the deer was killed because it wanted to know the meaning of everything, and he understood this because he was the same himself. He had heard his father say it to Tabakali, "Diskenka, Kuras boy, always want the answer. What dis mean? What dat mean?" His father had seemed pleased. The glowing, sightless eyes of the deer faded in the darkness among the trees, and Kenka drifted towards sleep. Chapter 50. Palavers were held at irregular intervals, whenever disputes occurred which could not be settled privately. They took place in the compound, in the open space between the stockade and the first huts. Though serious enough to the disputants, they were regarded as a form of entertainment by those not involved, and were always well attended. In the hot season, evening was the preferred time, but now, in the cooler weather, mid-morning was judged suitable, particularly as that evening would be taken up with the naming of Nima's latest child under the joint fathership of Kavana and Tiamoko, friends and partners, these two, sharing wife and trade interests. Nima had decided to have the naming on the same day as the palaver, so as to ensure a good attendance, desirable alike for prestige and the volume of gifts and good wishes. It was early still, not long after sunrise, and Paris was in his sick room, administering an infusion of quassia and dried orange peels to Libby, who had a jaundiced look in his solitary eye this morning, and had come with complaints of a night disturbed by vomiting. This morbid condition, accompanied in the first hours by a low fever, was one that Libby had suffered from at intervals for a good number of years now. He was not alone in this. Others of the crew people, though none of the Africans, were troubled by a recurrent fever, mystifying in its cause to Paris, as there seemed to be no evidence of reinfection. In some cases it took the form of a single mild bout lasting a day or two. In others there was a more dangerous period of closely spaced peaks. Libby's fever was accompanied by an evident obstruction of the bile, but this was not so with any of the others. It was difficult to see a pattern anywhere. However, the men seemed well enough between times, and there had been no deaths from fever since Rimmer's 5 summers ago. Paris himself had experienced no recurrence of the illness that had stricken him aboard ship, except for a tendency to ache and shiver when he caught the mildest chill. He had long since exhausted his store of quinchona. Now, to allay the fever and clear the blood, he relied on the powdered bark of the bitter ash, of which he had discovered isolated specimens growing on the shoreward side of some jungle hammocks, or on a concoction of sassafras. Libby was grateful enough in his surly way, and Paris took the opportunity to ask his opinion on the charge against Aboti, due to be heard later that morning. As he had expected from a hanger-on of Kireku, and it was really the purpose of his question, it was the shanty view that he got.
"We're clear as daylight," Libby said. "Aboti is guilty. He tried to kill Hambo just as much as if he'd stuck a knife into him. He was seen gathering dust from Hambo's footprint to make the fetish. Why should Hambo's woman say she's seen him if she never did?"
"She is Aboti's woman, too. Why she says this or that is what we hope to find out at the palaver." Libby made a gesture of contempt.
"Palaver's a shaggin' waste of time," he said. "The death fetish was found on Hambo's roof."
Paris looked curiously at the other man's face, which was pallid and swollen with the bad night he had passed. Libby borrowed opinions from those he served. Why not beliefs, too?
"I did not know you set so much store by fetishes, Libby," he said. "Me? A few sticks and feathers and a bit of spit?"
As he got up to go, Libby uttered a short laugh, not altogether convincing.
"When I am sick," he said, "don't I come for medicine? I don't go to a mansa begging for a charm."
After he had gone, Paris stood quietly without moving. There was an ugliness of spirit about Libby, which showed even when he was trying to be amiable, perhaps more then. A period of silence seemed necessary before the place could be healed of his visit. Paris knew this was a superstitious feeling, but superstition of one sort or another, like nostalgia, moved among them all, and this sick room, though open to everyone, was a very private place for him. It was where he came to commune with himself and with the past. Everything he possessed was here. His mahogany medicine chest stood on trestles of split palm log, and a small set of instruments, cleaned and polished, laid out in their slots of frayed plush, and his glass-stopped bottles set in a row. Barber had made him a cabinet out of mangrove wood, and he kept his collection of roots and oils and dried leaves on the shelves, and his few books in the drawer. In a certain way the past was gathered here, as it was in the cemetery. Paris had kept the splints he had used to set a broken leg, the charred cane with which he had vainly tried to cauterize a snake bite and save a life. In a jar on the shelf of his cabinet he kept the eel skin, carefully cured, from which in desperate haste he had fashioned a catheter to pass down the throat and into the stomach of a baby of 6 months that had swallowed some flakings of kunti root, poisonous before pulping and draining. The child had been at the point of death. Pulse and respiration had almost ceased. The improvised tube had enabled Paris to use his syringe to inject an emetic. It was a common pewter syringe, still there among his instruments. The effect had been miraculous. Within minutes the pulse had become perceptible again at the wrist, the convulsed action of the mouth had ceased, and the child had taken a quivering breath. Verging on the miraculous, too, that fortunate chance of the fresh eels caught from the creek, and the tiny quantity of ipecacuanha still remaining at that time among his medicines, the little girl was 6 years old now. Memories are grafted together in ways beyond our choosing. He could not think of the child saved without some memory of his lost Ruth, though his thoughts of her in these days most often went back before the time of their misfortunes to the early days of courtship and marriage. Now there came to his mind a day in spring when they had walked together along the shore near her parents' home in Norfolk. They had walked a long way, hand in hand, far beyond the harbour, to a deserted stretch of shore. The tide was out, he remembered, levels of rippled sand, the pale blue of the tide pools and the real sea beyond, darker, uniform to the horizon. Sunlight. The shingle was bright along the beach, and the bunches of wet kelp were gleaming. Terns were screaming overhead. He had brought his telescope to watch them, plunging for fish. Ruth had felt cold in the ruffling breeze from the sea, and he had used his tinderbox to make a fire of driftwood up among the dunes. Bright flame against the pale dune grass. They held out their hands to the flame and laughed at nothing but the joy of being there together. Her pale hands, reddened by the chill and then the fire. She had gone a little way alone to gather the blue flowers that grew there, that kept their colour when dried. He could not remember the name. He had followed with his eyes the slight, lonely figure against the sweep of the dunes. On an impulse, he had taken up the telescope and trained it on her. She was brought suddenly close before him, and he was amazed and deeply moved to see the cherishing and tentative way she put out her hand to the flowers. All the gentleness of her nature was in it. He had realized then that this was the way she touched everything, and he had been swept by such love for her that his sight for the moment seemed darkened and her figure lost. He was still standing in the same place half an hour later, when Nadri approached, carrying a fish trap he had made, which he was intending to leave here while he attended the palaver. In fact, he could have left it anywhere with perfect security. Theft was rare in the settlement. The nature of life was too public. But in any case, no one would have dreamed of carrying off his trap, because it was instantly recognizable for Nadri's. No one else made traps the equal of his, either for cunning or beauty. This one, which he set down at a corner of the sick room, was quite large, a yard or so in diameter, cylindrical in shape, with one end open and a funnel-shaped passageway leading to the interior. Warp splints made of willow sticks curved inward, admitting the entry of the fish into the maze-like filling of the trap, and the closed end had a wicker lid.
"That's a fish trap," Paris said. "I don't believe it."
Nadri smiled. His perfectionism in the matter of traps was a long-standing joke between them.
"Why, what do you think it is?"
Sharing the same woman had thrown them together, and over the years Nadri had picked up a good deal of English from Paris, helped in this by a good ear and a quick intelligence, and also, Paris had learned, by a grasp of language derived from his education. He was a Muslim, and he'd been taught as a child to read and write and figure in Arabic. Other things, too, Paris had learned by degrees. Nadri came from a region of high grasslands and wooded valleys behind the Ivory Coast, and had been clerk to a merchant, subsequently marrying his employer's daughter. It was while journeying on business for his father-in-law that he had been taken by a slaving party. He had a daughter, who would be 14 now, if she was still alive.
"Maybe looks good, I don't know," he said now. "But this trap is going to catch plenty of fish, I know that. One thing I find out, Matthew, while I've been here in this place."
"What is that?"
"A trap looks good, gives good result. Whether you after bird, or fish, or fox."
He smiled again. It was an attractive smile, lighting up the normally rather stern expression of his face with the prominent bones of the cheeks and temples.
12 summers here, I learn one thing," he said. "That is not so bad, I think."
Paris was silent for a moment, looking at this man to whom he was close, but who would never fully be his friend. Nadri was tall. The eyes that looked back at him were on a level with his own. They were the eyes that had looked into his in pain and bewilderment on the slave ship, as Nadri was whipped forward to be examined and branded. He was naked now above the waist, and the brand mark of Kemp showed livid on his chest. He had been the first that Paris had violated with his touch, as Tabakali had been the first of the women he had looked at and wanted. Now they shared her together. The woman had forgiven him, or so it seemed, perhaps because he had needed her so much. But for the man, there could be no forgetting that first encounter, for all the affection that had grown between them.
"It is a great pity that what you say of traps is not true also of people," Paris said. "At least then we would not be deceived."
Nadri spread his hands, revealing the paler, vulnerable-seeming skin of the palms.
"Trap is very simple thing," he said, "only has one purpose. When we say the name of it, we say what it is. People are not like that. I don't know why it is, Matthew. You are all the time wanting to make some kind of laws for people. Why are you never content to look at one person than another person?"
There was a note of reproof in this, stronger, as it seemed to Paris, than his own rather mild words had warranted. Some of the warmth left his face. He took no more kindly now than he ever had to being told how to shape his thoughts, and Nadri's constitutional unwillingness to generalize about human behavior had caused arguments between them before.
"If we cannot proceed from particular truths to general ones, our thoughts will get nowhere," he said. "Better for us you get nowhere," Nadri said. "Particular to general is story of the slave trade, I think."
"That is not fair, Nadri. If you bring everything down to that, we cannot discuss things at all."
However, he had seen quite suddenly that Nadri's resentment came from wanting to be separate and free, not wanting to be herded, as it were, into a law of human nature.
"It is only an attempt at understanding," he said more gently. "We are all here by accident." "No excuse me. You are here by accident. I am here because you bring me. For accident, there must be choosing somewhere. That is one big difference between us, Matthew. The crew people here because they kill the captain. You say an attempt understanding, but it is only an attempt proving your ideas the right ones. First, you bring us. Say we are free. Then you want to make us serve some idea in your head. But the people cannot serve your idea. You cannot make them do that."
Paris did not reply at once. He was not so much dashed by the argument. He could not see how he could be held guilty of coercion simply by virtue of his own mental processes, as hurt in some obscure way by Nadri's remark about the difference between them. It was true he bore a responsibility that none of the black people could be expected to share. Even the people of the crew he felt to be less accountable than himself. They had shared the physical misery of the Negroes in a way he had not. They had been flogged in the Negroes' view. They had begged from the Negroes' bowls. No doubt it was for this reason they had been able to settle here together on equal terms. Paris had found happiness here. He knew himself to be useful and respected, but he knew also that in certain essential respects he was quite alone.
"Only way to live here is day by day, same as anywhere,"
Nadri said in a different tone.
A wise man knows his limits. Like the Trucky, you know.
What is Trucky? Nadri was fond of Paris, and had seen that he was hurt. He allowed his face to assume the expression, sly and slightly ironic, which it always wore on his excursions into folk wisdom.
Trucky is Tortos, he said. Maybe Tortos won fight, but he sabi him arm short.
Your arm long enough, Paris said, smiling in sudden relief. You arm long pass anyone this place.
A surge of affection for Nadri came with the words. The use of pigeon often released feeling between them in this way. Between those men who shared a woman, which was still the case with most, feelings were rarely neutral. There sometimes grew enmity and sometimes a close bond. But Paris knew that the grace of the friendship came from Nadri, and the sense of this, a feeling close to gratitude, pained his throat still when he thought of it. Now, true to the restraints of his upbringing, he sought for a way to continue that would not betray his feeling.
Tabakali, he said, that one woman look good and good in sigh.
That de perfect truth, Nadri said gravely. She one fine woman.
The two nodded together on this, and the silence of total accord fell upon them, broken after some time by Nadri.
Time for palaver, he said. They are coming together.
They left the sick room and made their way across to the wide clearing before the stockade gates, where people were already assembled, men, women and children, seated on mats brought for the purpose, in two files, facing inwards, separated by the space of a dozen feet or so. Paris noted Hughes among them, and Amos, and Kavanagh, men often away from the settlement. Kavanagh, of course, would have returned for the naming. Tabakali and the youngest child were there already, and Paris and Nadri joined them. The Beck man, or holder of the stick, elected for this occasion, was Billy Blair, a man without discernible interest to serve save that of justice, having no cultivation in common or trade connection with either of the disputing parties. He sat between the files at one end, holding the elegant silver-headed cane that had once belonged to Delblanc. He it was who, a year or so before his death, had introduced this regulating device into the chaos of their earlier debates. No one could address the assembly unless he was on his feet, between the files, and holding the cane, and it was the task of the Beckman to make sure this rule was observed. As was customary, the accuser spoke first. Hambo walked to and fro between the lines, gesturing fiercely with the cane. Iboti, he said, to try to kill him by making a powerful fetish and attaching it to the roof of his hut. He had returned to his hut to find the fetish bundle in the thatch. Danka had seen him find it. The bundle contained dried leaves, two sticks, one of them sharpened, and two cane whistles, one of them filled with dust. He knew Iboti had put it there because Iboti had threatened to kill him. He had threatened this in the hearing of Arifa, the woman they shared.
"He say he kill me," Hambo said, with a prolonged flourish of the stick. "He say make me eye blind, gut rot, spit blood. Arifa hear him say it." "Dat lie!"
Iboti shouted suddenly from his place beside Tongman.
"Hambo, you say lie!"
He swallowed, and the whites of his eyes showed prominently as he glanced from side to side of him.
"You call me lie?"
Hambo stopped near Iboti and glowered down at him.
"You pig bullum! You call me lie, I break your throat," he said. "Iboti," Billy said, "your turn come by and by. Hambo got his stick now. Hambo, you talk bad mouth, I take back stick. You altogether finish."
Sullenly, Hambo gave back a little, and after a moment resumed his pacing. He was shorter than the other shanty, stocky in build and deep-chested. The column of his neck was not much narrower than the back of his head, which gave him the look of having been hewn from a single block. In contrast to his fierce gestures, he spoke rather slowly, pausing sometimes to marshal his thoughts. In these pauses he made loud spitting sounds in token of the truth of his words. Arifa, he said, had not only heard the threats, but had seen Iboti gathering dust from a footprint, as she would shortly be telling them.
"Now! I show fetish. You sabi I speak truth," he said.
He went to his place, took up the bundle and held it above his head for all to see.
"Leaf look de bombiri leaf, he said. Maybe Iboti find bombiri tree.
Tong Man rose. It was the right of the accused person, or the one speaking for him, to address questions to the Beck man.
What de sarve? He said. I ask what purpose all de servan, whether de bombiri leaf or no, who care about that?
What de purpose?
Billy asked Hambo.
Bombiri leaf, fall quick, when him stick cut from tree. Dat mean bad fetish, make house fall down me. Tongman, you head go soft. You sabi that before.
Billy thought for some time, his small, pugnacious face tight with the seriousness of his office. There was tension in the air of the meeting, and he was feeling it along with everybody else. Apart from the occasional voices of the smaller children, complete silence reigned among the people gathered there.
Humbo got de right, Billy said. He try and show us dis fetish strong too much. Capsai him house.
Encouraged thus, and aware of the intense interest of his audience, Hambo went on to draw attention to the two sticks, one blunt and one sharpened, the sharp one being Unkumba, the second spear of witchcraft. Finally, he held up the dust-stopped whistle.
Dust under him foot, he said. Arifa see him take it. Dust in whistle make Hambo die. Foul him windpipe.
He strode back and forth some time longer, still waving the cane, but it was clear that he had stated his case and was now merely repeating it, a favoured rhetorical device of the shanty. After some minutes of this, Billy asked for the return of the stick, which passed next to Arifa. She was a big woman, built on voluptuous lines, with heavy features and a stolid expression, somewhat redeemed by the coquetry of luxuriant eyelashes. She had taken particular care with her appearance for this public occasion. White cowrie shells, exactly matched, adorned the large lobes of her ears, and a gold coin, found on the beach by Callie and obtained from him by means everyone knew of, hung shining between her breasts. These were not very much concealed by the cotton wrap thrown with studied negligence over her shoulders, and they swayed and swung magnificently with the motions of her narrative.
Yes, she had heard Iboti utter the death threats.
He had threatened, among other things, to open up Hambo from puga to chin and to cut off his testicles and compel him to eat them. Some laughter came from the audience at this, whether from the sense that a man with his belly cut open would not be in a fit state to eat his own testicles, or at the very evident contrast in physique between the two men. But the silence of total absorption returned when Arifa began to tell of seeing Iboti gather up the dust. She had seen him stoop and take up the dust in the palm of his hand and move away with it in the direction of his hut. It had been just after sunrise. She was outside her hut, putting pulped kunti roots into a basket, so as to take them and wash them in the creek.
"He hold dat dust like it water in him hand," she said in her strong contralto voice, "like cargo gold dust. Never take me like that. Iboti ball go sleep long time ago."
Iboti lowered his head in humiliation at this. Paris heard Tabakali beside him utter a harsh exhalation of anger and contempt. She had never liked Arifa.
"That one bumbot woman," she said loudly. "She put man out when Hambo say, then she say fault him ball, that one fat bumbot hussy. Tabakali, store you garb, you pinion Arifa, not the bloody question," Billy said. "You no fraid, Iboti," Tabakali called. "You find another woman, good past this one. Matthew, Nadri, you woman no keep mum, we still here tomorrow. Stick past to Hambo again. Ask for Iboti punish."
Hambo's plea for the punishment of his alleged evil wisher was brief.
"Dis man try kill me," he said. "What he go give me now? He poor like cabo, like rat. He give me bag kunti root? Ha! Hambo life worth more than bag kunti. My country, man try kill me, I kill him. We kill Wilson long time ago for kill one man. But Hambo, good heart, no ask Iboti kill. Ask him save me 3 year gremetto. Carry cargo for shanty. I finish now. Give back the stick."
Silence at this was complete. Paris saw Kireku and Danka sitting side by side, nodding in grave assent, and behind them the face of Barton, raised and peering in that old expression of his, that relish of the scent of weakness. Libby was there too, and Hambo's woman had returned to her place among them. It was a phalanx of power. The shock of the announcement brought a sense of cleared vision to Paris, like a slap that first blurs the eyes, then sharpens them. He understood now that Hambo had never meant to ask for goods in compensation, that he must have intended all along to demand this term of labour. Others must be realising it too. He glanced at some of the faces nearest him. They were deeply absorbed, but he saw no sign of any strong dissent. Nadri was frowning slightly, it seemed in concentration, and Sullivan's face showed a sort of startlement, as if he had just awoken. Beyond them, Jimmy sat cross-legged. The smile, for once, was absent, but Paris knew in that moment, with a sort of prophetic chill, that Iboti's bondage to the shanty, if it became a fact, would be incorporated by the teacher into the history of the settlement. It would become a story with a moral, like the mutiny, Wilson's execution, the freeing of the Indians. In the course of time, the people would come to believe that a term of servitude was fitting punishment. The slave who had tried to kill himself with his own nails on board the ship, there had been a fetish somewhere in that, too. He had been wrongly accused. It was Jimmy who had explained it. The silence continued as the stick was returned. Billy was beginning to look harassed. There was no precedent for Hambo's demand. Labour had sometimes been imposed, but only for specific tasks and when there was clear evidence of some previous contract or undertaking, to repair a roof, for example, or cut a certain quantity of wood.
"We listen both say, then see," Billy said at last.
Paris scrambled to his feet. "I ask Hambo change him word," he said to Billy, in a voice vibrant with feeling. "I ask him think what we do here. We forget how we come here, where we come from. We come dis place make man free or make him slave."
"Dat not question. Dat you opinion."
Billy shook his head from side to side as if to clear it. The familiar nightmare of logical incoherence was descending on him.
"Sound like question, but it not. You no can say opinion without de stick. No can get stick till finish both side palaver. But if he is found guilty," Paris said, abandoning Pigeon in the stress of his feelings, "if the vote goes against him, it will be a vote also on this demand for servitude, not only on the crime itself. It will be too late to modify the punishment, except in degree, not in its nature. And not only that, it will establish..."
"What lingo dis?"
Kireku was on his feet now, a tall, imposing figure.
"Why you talk dis rubbish lingo?"
He surveyed Paris steadily for some moments with an expression of frowning severity.
"My friend, you talk people lingo, or you get down stogab altogether," he said.
He extended his arm in a sudden fierce gesture, notably at odds with the dignified calm of his speech.
"You, Beckman," he said, turning towards Billy. "You no sabi keep palaver, you get down. Give place better man." "Dat man not you,"
Inchebi shouted, in immediate defence of his friend.
"Shanty Beckman say everything for shanty."
Billy's face had gone red as fire, and he had taken a hard grip on de Blanc's cane. His first words, perhaps fortunately, were impeded by rage and not properly audible to Kareku. It was at this point that Tongman, with a superb sense of timing, rose to his feet.
"Why dis palaver about punish?" he demanded. "Iboti not punish, done nothing wrong. I speak for Iboti now. I ask for the stick."
Once armed with this, he moved between the files, portly and unruffled. His forensic style was completely different from Hambo's. He did not gesture and declaim, but appealed directly to his audience with an air of taking them into his confidence. There were some strange features in this case, he said, and one of the strangest was the ease with which Hambo had come upon the fetish. In his, Tongman's, experience, and he had no doubt this corresponded to the experience of his audience, when a man went to the trouble of making up a fetish bundle and placing it on another man's roof, he generally concealed it well. intending that it should remain there for as long as possible so as to have its full effect. Indeed, it was usually only when a roof was repaired that a fetish was found in the thatch. Sounds of assent came from here and there among his listeners, and Tongman nodded and smiled.